Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Faith Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernacle. I'm your host, Brian Dillman. Today we have a great episode. I finally got to record our first in the series of book club episodes. We started this idea to read six books this year, six Mormon fiction books this year. And the first book is The Scholar of Moab, and I have two great participants who read the book and had lots of neat thoughts on it. So that's the episode today. I have one little thing to say about it before we jump to it. This is a book by Steve Peck, who a lot of you probably already know. He's been on the podcast before. He's a professor at BYU. And at one point, I talk about being perplexed by him. And I don't want to give anyone, especially dear brother Peck, the idea that I'm perplexed as in frustrated. I said perplexed because I wish I had the breadth and depth of skill with creativity, language, science, all that stuff that Steve has excelled at for a long time. And so it's a little bit of an expression of jealousy, if anything. But the conversation was fun. It was quite fluid, so I moved some things around, so if it feels maybe a little bit disjointed at one time or another, that's probably why. But I think there's a lot of great insights. If you haven't read the book, please go read it now, unless you don't mind spoilers, because we talk about the whole thing. We don't protect the listener from the plot line and the ending and different things that happen in the book. So if you haven't read the book, go read it. Then come back and listen to the conversation. And while we're at it, why don't we jump right to it? So we've got the first discussion of the Mormon Fiction Book Club, where we're reading some books that I chose by asking lots of people what the best Mormon fiction books are. Fiction written by Mormons and usually in some way relating to, if not centrally, about Mormon life at some period in time. And today we are talking about The Scholar of Moab. So I've got Emily Flinders and Milt Radford, who have both participated in reading the book, and now we're going to talk about it. Emily and Milt, why don't you say hi?
Hello.
Hi there.
All right. I think this will be fun. The book for me was a lot of fun. It was kind of, in some ways, a little bit nostalgic thinking about growing up in a semi-rural area and hanging out with people that talk in that sort of way, like the main character in the book, Hiram Thayne. Before we get started, Emily, why don't you tell us a little bit about the structure of this book, because it's not your typical chapter by chapter linear narrative.
Okay. So Peck uses what we're calling the epistolary style in this, where the novel is made up of a bunch of different types of documents. So each, we would say, chapter is a different document, although some are significantly longer than others. Mainly those source documents are comprised of the main character, Hiram Thayne's journal entries, poems and letters by Dora, the poet and mistress, letters to and from the Babcock twins from the redactor, who is the character who's compiling all this information to make sense of this story. And there are, one or two poems by Hiram's wife, Sandra, and just a couple other types of documents that help piece together the information that I guess is pertinent to the direction Peck wanted the story to go. So rather than reading something chronological from beginning to end, or, you know, the only thing tying all of these different types of documents together is the way they relate to this story that's being built in the reader's head as all this information comes from different places.
As you both recall, what are some other books that you can think of that follow this form, like the Screwtape Letters. Was that was just two. What were the names? Now I remember Wormwood and whoever his master devil was that he was learning from, if I recall correctly. But that was just letters back and forth. What are some other ones that take this epistolary form?
There was one of Card's novels that did that.
Oh, really?
There's some of that going on in the Ender series. Daddy Long Legs was one.
So I just listened to World War Z, which is kind of like this, where it's a series of interviews. So kind of like you have the redactor, you have the interviewer talking to all these different people that have these different perspectives on the big zombie war. In this book, as well as in World War Z, the narrative does move forward. It doesn't jump back and forth a whole lot, but you get it from all these different voices instead of one continuous omniscient narrator.
Yeah, and I mean, I have more background in film than in literature, so it's reminding me of the much discussed Rashomon, where you tell the same story from four or five different perspectives, and what actually happens changes depending on whose perspective you're looking at. And so, while I don't think Peck went that far with introducing different perspectives, it's still a really ambitious way to tell a story because there's so many different ways that it can be put back together by the reader when the parts are so separated from one another. So the work that the reader has to do to engage with the text becomes a lot more work-like than it does in a lot of easier to read, more straightforward, I'm feeding you what the meaning of this is type of novels.
Right. That's kind of when I started this, because I had heard of it being lauded by all sorts of people in the Mormon blog world. When I started reading it, I thought, oh, crap, this is going to be like putting a puzzle together. And one thing, so the other book that I just finished 5 minutes before we started this was Dracula. And that, in one of the Wikipedia articles I looked up about the epistolary form, is like the quintessential model, at least according to that article. And I actually read them both similarly. As my boys fall asleep and I kind of stay in the room for a while, I would turn on the iPad and read it on the Kindle software, read like through one document or one journal entry. And so it was kind of a different experience than a lot of books where you sit down and read a whole lot. I would just read a little bit, one chunk at a time, which is different from the way that I would read, you know, that I would stay up all night reading the Harry Potter books, because they're very plot driven and they're written in a way to kind of keep you moving through the whole thing.
Yeah, for better or worse, I think it really does engage the reader. You have to become an active part of it, of whether it's almost as a detective or, you know, imprinting some of your own perspective on it. I thought it was interesting, you know, if you had a spectrum of Mormon readers, from people who are very involved in the church to those who are not, I wondered how they would perceive this particular novel as they read through it.
On that note, I was very intrigued by the way Peck treated the religious or Mormon aspect of this book, because he almost seemed to be trying to write from a place where the Mormon-ness of the novel was irrelevant, where it almost wouldn't matter how the reader felt about the church itself, because he wasn't trying to say anything about the church, despite it being in so ever-present in all these characters' everyday life. So,
and it was mostly in Hiram's character, right? Like the Babcock twins, they were never LDS, if I recall.
Correct.
And
Dora was not.
And Dora was not either. And the redactor didn't give away anything about himself.
Right.
Yeah, and so it's really just part of Hiram's character, I think. Hiram and his wife.
Not even a really elemental part of his character, just kind of, it's almost like part of the setting rather than part of the character.
Yeah, so you could take it a lot of different ways. It could be endearing, or it could be annoying, or it could be, you know, just part of the scenery, depending on your own personal view, I suppose.
Does that reflect a Utah view of Mormonism? I mean, I only lived in the state for 3 years when I was in school, but, you know, I almost got a sense of it in reading this book that, yeah, it's Mormonism is just a part of the fabric of Utah, and no big deal is made about that.
To some extent, yeah. And I think there are a lot of people who like some of the characters, like Hiram and Sandra, don't see any separation between Mormonism and spirituality. Like, if you're going to be spiritual, it's going to be through Mormon channels. There are no other options that they can conceive of.
Yeah.
Which doesn't mean that they necessarily feel like they need to be extremely spiritual, but that's the only way of being spiritual that makes any sense to them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the only way they know. All right. So let's do a quick story arc just so we know kind of what happens. It's basically this, there's actually a lot of strange things.
If you try to sum up this story shortly, it's going to sound quite left fieldish. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe the story arc's not the best thing, but I'll try anyway. So it's basically just about Hiram Thayne, this rural country guy. He's has a wife and he works up in the mountains with some geologists, and they're setting explosives to make underground maps of the rocks and things that they might drill into. And it's just a set like 2 years of his life. And it's interesting, kind of going back to the having all the different sources, you get a feel that of what he's openly interested in, that he must be thinking about this journal, that someone is going to read it, because there's elements in the story, like with Dora Daphne, the mistress, that don't show up in his journal. And so there are events that go on that he just doesn't record, and other people do. And so there's all kinds of crazy things. There's this folklore, or this, I guess you would say, more of a personal experience with aliens landing. But a lot of people think it's just a story. Hiram does try to learn some different things. He seems to be a very eager learner with what he has. And he inadvertently incites a paranoia, a communist conspiracy paranoia in the town. And that really leads up to the end of his story, anyway, the end of his life. And so it's, yeah, this story arc part is not turning out. It's just kind of a crazy story. We'll leave it at that. So for the discussion, we've kind of talked about the form a little bit already. So just let's just give it a rating overall. I mean, so we'll use the Goodreads 5-star scale, and maybe tell us what your rating was and tell us how you rate things. For example, when I rate things, I rate a book right after I read it, and I'm usually in this kind of euphoric state because it was just so much fun to read whatever it was that I just read. So I give out a lot of 5-stars, and my wife does not. She's more of a critical reader, and it takes a really great book to get a high rating from her. And so I gave it 5-stars because I just had a lot of fun reading it. I wasn't really critical of it until later, when Emily and I started chatting about it offside. And then I thought, oh, that's interesting. I just thought it was wonderful at the time. Now I'm seeing all these different ways to look at it. Anyway, so I gave it 5-stars. It was a lot of fun to read. What did you two think, Emily and Milt?
Okay. I have a really hard time rating things with a flat out, like, you know, rating things that are so different in nature on the same scale. So some things this novel did really well were finding creative ways to introduce and kind of discuss and dance around really complex esoteric ideas. If you look at some of the reviews of it, especially the ones that Adam Miller did, there's some really phenomenal deep concepts that he introduces through these characters' experiences. However, I kind of struggled with the way this book treated both basic plot and basic character development, because I felt like it was so caught up in the, you know, on that deep, deep level of how can I be really creative with how I introduce ideas that most people will never even think to contemplate in their lifetime, that the characters themselves didn't ever change very much. They were just kind of there to illustrate the ideas. And, you know, I prefer to be able to engage with both characters and ideas. So I probably would have, I guess, enjoyed the reading and found it less laborious if I had been able to care about the characters a little earlier on in the story. I found I had to do a lot of work in my own head to get to where I cared about them enough to be curious. And I feel like curiosity is what drives the reading experience. So, that was the biggest, so basically my complaint is that the author is too smart.
That he is.
I guess, like, but I'm not someone that like wants a really, really easy read necessarily, but I guess based on my life experience and interests and areas of expertise, I didn't have as much fun reading it as you did, Brian.
No.
But I still found it a very valuable text to work through. And part of that came up with some of the things that you and I discussed earlier, with some gender dichotomy going on in the story that was a little strange to me.
Yeah, and we can talk more about that stuff a little bit later. Milt, how did you rate it? Are you willing to give it a rating, or are you going to pull a Emily on us? And
sure. You know, when I finished reading it a few months ago, I probably would have given it a 4. I might nudge that up a little more to a 4.5 or something. I tend to agree that I wish that there had been better character development. And I know that the style of the novel kind of, it's hard to do that sometimes. For whatever reason, I found Dora to be kind of fascinating, and I wanted to know more about her. I felt like I figured out Hiram, or at least I thought I did anyway. I liked, again, back to the open interpretation. We haven't mentioned it yet, but the Gadianton robbers make an appearance in this novel.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can interpret that any way you want. Some people thought that they were real and hiding out in the LaSalle Mountains. And other people, you know, just thought it was nonsense. And maybe some people thought it was symbolic. I really liked just sort of stitching together everything in my own mind. I think this particular format of novel worked for me. You know, I've had like a couple of family experiences where I had to go through documents and things after someone had passed on, and I learned things that I had never known before. So I can empathize a little bit with the redactor in the story. But for me, I mean, generally I like a linear novel as well, but for whatever reason, this worked for me. I liked the style.
Cool. So let's talk about some of these characters or voices or source documents. Those three terms kind of collapse into each other, it seems, with this book. I think the one, like I said, I liked a lot of just the language. The story was just kind of zany. But I wrote a review about it, and I captured all of the funny little things that Hiram would say that were like little lessons or little country metaphors. Like he says, my curiosity was raising itself up like a newborn lamb ready for her first suck, and I was about that shaky. And he talks about there was a student that came down. I can't remember his name. It might be Brian. I can't remember, though, that was working for the summer, and I kind of wonder if Peck is projecting his college self onto this character a little bit, because he was a philosophy major and a geology major. As they were driving up in the mountains, he was looking at road cuts to see what kind of rocks are there. And he said he was staring hard at road cuts with his head halfway out the truck like a farm dog on a way to a picnic. So I liked all of that kind of language. It just felt, it was humorous, and it reminded me of growing up in Syracuse. And it also reminded me of a good friend of mine while I was in graduate school in Iowa that was from Wisconsin. And so then I collected a bunch of other sayings from him and some other people, like happy as a pig. I'm sorry. I just reading this, and there was another good guy that I got to know. He passed on in Iowa, and he had a lot of really funny sayings, like he runned off faster than a scalded dog, or happy as a dead pig in the sun. Just these kind of strange sayings that when you're out in the country, it just, for some reason, it makes perfect sense of what they're trying to get after. So I found that endearing. So I liked Hiram. But at the same time, after I started talking with Emily online, I was really, that caused me to realize I have frustrations with Hiram as well, because he doesn't progress. Like, he really wants to learn things, and he ends up reading a bunch of Dickens, and he does some science experiments, but he's still the same guy. He doesn't really become more enlightened or more authentic or forthright or more honest. He's always kind of living a double life, from the whole to the whole mistress thing seems to have always been part of his life in one degree or another. So I did like Hiram, but at the same time, it was frustrating to not see him actually develop into something deeper than the guy that you meet in the first few journal entries. So what voices did you like? Or let's just talk about characters a little bit, or the voices in more depth.
Yeah, I think if you don't connect with Hiram in that very first source document, you're going to end up where I was, where you're having a hard time caring about him for the rest of the story. I mean, looking at, for example, how he treats his references to Dora in his journal, where he refers to her as a guy friend, this one person. I don't think he just calls it a friend and refers to her as a he.
Mm.
And it's apparent that that he's troubled by the way things are playing out, but there's no indication anywhere that that's ever a catalyst for any kind of change for him. It's just, oh, well, that's troubling. I can't or I won't change anything about myself to change that situation. So that was uncomfortable for me as a female reader. Then there were the totally different, I mean, it's really interesting to watch how one author manages to climb into all these characters and create these very, very different source documents. You know, it's easy to forget that it's all created by one person, because there was a lot of breadth in them.
One of the things that kind of perplexes me about him as a person is that he's a successful research scientist. He writes poetry, he writes fiction, and he has really good philosophy essays as well, from the different books and essays that I've read of his. And so he really does inhabit a broad range of space. And so once I kind of knew who he was a little bit more, and as I read this, it made a lot of sense that it's almost like he needed to write a book like this. Because,
to get to all the parts of himself.
Yeah, to get to all the parts of himself. Like, he's like, well, I love poetry, and I also like philosophy, and I like being a scientist, and I like telling stories. And so he kind of has a character or a source document for each one of those aspects of himself, anyway, that I'm aware of. Maybe he's got even more facets that are secret. Who knows?
I saw some of that in the twins, really triplets if you read the book.
Yeah.
And you know, I was so fascinated by them. At first I thought, oh, this is just some quirky thing throw in the book to get your attention. But obviously, as they developed and some of that dialogue and between the two of them, one is a religious believer, the other is an atheist, and then the third so-called member of that sometimes directs them in ways that they don't even understand themselves. I don't know how much of that was accurate, physiologically accurate, but, you know, I thought, well, don't we always talk about the dual nature of mankind, how we each have a good and a bad side, or polar opposites in how we approach problems and how we deal with things. And were the twins, you know, to me, they seemed like a physical representation of the fact that we are multiple people, whether we want to admit that or not. And I was fascinated by them. I'd like to see Peck write a book about the twins. That'd be interesting to me.
Yeah, that was one of Adam Miller's responses to this book was a post about, he called it intervideoality. I don't know if that's the term. But what's interesting is the one twin says that he is not religious and does not believe in God. The other twin doesn't say he believes. He says he has a relationship with God. And I think that kind of parallels how they both have a relationship with this third presence within their body. That it's Marcel, right? Is the name they give it.
The neural mass, the separate neural mass that kind of directs them.
Yeah. And I think that was some kind of a deliberate statement on like a difference between belief and relationship and how that plays into religion. But also how that plays into how we are multiple and how we perceive of ourselves and our relationships with God or with others. And how much of that has to do with the reality of relationships and the immateriality of them as well.
So after this book, I read another book of his that he did. What's that called? Evolving Faith. And the first half of that is all philosophical arguments about the problem of evil, the existence of God, about science and subjectivity and subjective truth and all sorts of things. And they're very energy intensive to get through. The second half is really enjoyable because they're more stories about his life and really meaning-making events for him. Once you have that in hand and you have the Babcock twins, you see him interjecting this drive that he has to do that sort of esoteric thinking and arguing and analysis. So that's another example of him projecting some of the interest that he has into, you know, an otherwise just a crazy story. I mean, you wouldn't expect to have philosophy in a story about a cowboy
conjoined
twins in southern Utah.
An alien abduction, yes.
Yeah. As I was thinking about the characters, they're interesting because they're so different, but kind of like Hiram, none of them really progress. I mean, maybe the one Babcock twin, William, who speaks most of the time, he seems to maybe not evolve very much, but he expresses the most
complexity
as a character. Yeah. Where the others, you kind of get to know who they are and they just get put into different situations and kind of do the same thing throughout the book.
No, and I think definitely with what happens with the death of the twins at the end, the episode with William right before he dies. I mean, that's the closest the entire novel comes to having a character undergo a significant change.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very brief.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have one question that's bothered me about this book, and I wonder what you guys think. So towards the beginning, there's a minor character called the Bob that Hiram has to work with, and he can't stand the guy. And the Bob picks him up at his trailer. Hiram gets in the truck and they go to work, and Hiram lies and says that that was a friend's house or a relative's house or something, and he lived somewhere else, and he wanted to project that he was actually wealthy, that he didn't live in a trailer park. And the Bob says, "What a Dickensian life you lead." And that kind of kicks off throughout the rest of the book, or at least a good portion of the book. First of all, Hiram has no idea what a Dickensian life means, and it takes him a while to even know who Dickens is. But he does end up finding out who Dickens is, and he reads collected works of Dickens for a while and really enjoys it. But my question is, did Hiram ever figure out, in your opinion, what the Bob meant by "what a Dickensian life you lead"?
I don't think he does to his satisfaction. And
I would agree with that, yeah.
I mean, the way that the Bob is treated in the novel, I mean, we aren't even clear on how much thought he gave to the statement before he made it. So
yeah, that's true. So there is one bit on page 66 where Hiram, I think he was up watching TV, and there's like a rabbi or something on there that causes him to think. And he says, "It was clear that fast that Dickensian meant a deep bleakness and poverty and misery suffered for a purpose that will eventually turn into light." And I'm just not sure if that's right, because I'm thinking of Great Expectations. That's not quite right, because they start in bleakness and poverty and kind of get out of that for a while, but then they end up back in there. And it's the whole thing is a facade throughout the story, or multiple facades from different people.
Dickens was relatively fond of happy endings from a financial standpoint. I'm sure they were also more profitable for him as an author.
Yeah.
But he did almost consistently address like socioeconomic issues with his writing. And so the poverty, I think, is inevitably relevant when you're talking about Dickens. But the redemption side of it varies a lot depending on which novel
right.
you look at. So I think that Hiram clung to that meaning because teleologically, that's what made that thought of the word Dickensian driving him crazy completely go away. Because
so it resolved the
that was a meaning of Dickensian that resolved everything for him. I doubt very much that the Bob meant something that flattering when he
right yeah
that term, you know, after Thane had, you know, obviously lied to him trying to improve the appearance of his living conditions. So
right, that's what bothered me, is that he said that and I'm like, that's not what the Bob was getting at. Like, he never, and maybe this gets back to your frustration with Hiram, that he never makes a change. He never kind of admits a mistake. So he, in this moment of digging, reading through all of Dickens, he never thought, at least he didn't express in his journal, that he said Dickensian because I was lying to him that day, that I was trying to live a life that was not my own. I was trying to look more wealthy than I really am. And so that really just grated on me throughout the whole thing, that he never figured that out, even after reading all of that he did read.
Yes, you would think that somewhere in here Peck would find a way to illustrate how reading can make one a better person, right?
Yeah.
But he doesn't manage to do that with Hiram.
No.
And Hiram's use of the English language doesn't improve a whole lot, even after all of his reading.
Yeah, which is kind of fun to read. But yeah, if you're looking at a character to develop and change, it's just another way to express his countryness.
Yeah, well, and not just his countryness, but as a character, his self-absorption.
Yeah.
Which is why I think that definition of Dickensian worked for him, because it was flattering to him. He never manages to do anything that strikes me as terribly unselfish in the entire novel. So that was my perspective of that character.
He was interested in things, but just because he was interested in them, not because it was serving any great purpose. Or for anyone else, yeah.
Well, and he flattered himself that he was a scholar,
right.
Whereas, it, you know, depending on how you want to define scholar, he could have been considered a far cry from that. But there was a lot of self-flattery going on in his journal entries, and the way he seemed to make his decisions was largely based on what was the most self-serving. There wasn't a lot of thoughtfulness of others in any of that. And
okay.
I just shook my head a lot at this poor child.
Milt, did you think that Steve Peck was trying to say something or trying to make a clear statement about anything in particular through this book? Or was it just a wild story?
I felt like there was the issue of individual perception of how things are. And I thought a lot about the redactor. We don't know who he was or she even, but, you know, trying to figure out Hiram's life and everyone else from this little shoebox or whatever they found of stuff. I really tried to, you know, reconcile that in my own head. And at times it was really confusing, but I still liked the fact that, you know, people were wrestling with this all throughout the novel. They were individually wrestling with who they were, and as a consequence, because the reader has to fill in the blanks and, you know, write part of the novel themselves, so to speak. I think, you know, to me, again, it's just, it's what I read into it. And I don't know if my version's any better than anybody else's, but I just really appreciated the fact that you can look at sometimes the simplest things, and whether you interpret those literally or figuratively can have a dramatic influence on your life and everyone around you. Maybe that was just the space that my head was in when I read the book a few months ago. But I felt like he was trying to make that statement that perception is important.
Hmm. Interesting. Emily, did you identify any particular thing Peck might have been trying to accomplish?
I think what he did really well and thoroughly with this book was introducing a lot of questions and being very careful never to get definitive answers to them. So yes, perception, I think, as Milt was saying, becomes something that you can't get around. You can't say, well, this is what really happened, because you're never told as a reader what really happened. You're only told, this is how this character perceived what happened. This is how this character perceived what happened. And there is no definitive answer of what actually happened. So you're kind of forced to deal with the inevitable fallacy in everyone's perception, how everyone's a little bit wrong or a lot wrong. and you're not able to trust that anyone's perception of what's happened is accurate. But you're also not able to discount anyone's perception. I think that's especially becomes relevant with Dora, who insists that she's had these alien encounters. You're not ever able to say that didn't happen to her or that did happen to her.
Right.
The only thing you're able to say for sure is she definitely believes that that's what happened. And that's, you know, a really interesting way to play with belief and perception and relationships. When you're not trying to arrive at a conclusion, or you're not succeeding or expecting to succeed in arriving at a conclusion about who's right and who's wrong, and or what in particular is wrong about different people's perception. But rather just giving space for all of these things to be valid statements of what different people's perception is, without ever driving that toward a definitive conclusion. Oh, this is what really happened. So there's a lot of plot questions that are never answered in the novel. But that ultimately works really effectively at leaving the reader thinking after reading the novel is over about the things that I think the author might have wanted to get them to think about in the first place. So it works really well at getting people to think. It doesn't work really well at wrapping up a story neatly so that you can put it on the shelf and fully give it a 5-star rating and not think about it again.
So it's like he's a guy that teaches philosophy classes at a university or something to get you to think.
Something, yeah.
I rarely think that a book is too short. My attention span is not very good. And I think maybe that has a lot to do with a career where I've worked in journalism. I want to edit everybody and get something down to a smaller size. But this was one book where, honestly, I wished it had been twice the size it was, because I wanted to know a lot more. Just as Emily said, I wanted to know a lot more about some of these people and the plot and what was motivating them to do things. I would have gladly read a longer book to have some of those questions answered.
Mm. Interesting.
And maybe we could have gotten more character development with twice as much book, and everyone would have been happy. So write a longer book next time, Steve.
All right. So what was your favorite quote or moment from the book?
Favorite quote or moment? Okay, my favorite moment is when Dora catches Hiram when he's trying to wrap things up, and he's saying he's going to like give a blessing, and
he's got all the people from the church following him out into the...
Yeah, and it's the only moment I really noticed in the whole book that like treated the way that these people believed in Hiram with any dignity. And I think without that moment, I probably would have had an issue with the way Peck was treating Mormonism in this book. But there's this one moment in the whole story where she sees something really deeply holy in the way that these people, you know, are believing and following Hiram. But that moment in the novel was a important part for me. And I thought, and I, you know, it was written from her perspective and she's the poet. So it was also easy on the eyes. This is in source document number 28. In my book, it's page 231. And this is Dora speaking. She's watching Hiram attempt to convince a group of the congregation that he has taken care of Gadeon robbers by saying a kind of ceremonial prayer. She says, "I suddenly found myself raging, mad and teary-eyed. There was something so sincere about this prayer, something so deeply rooted in these people and their land that my sense of their silliness melted away. They seemed wholesome to me. People of the land, salt of the earth. They were all in tears, except Sandra, Hiram's wife. She seemed subdued, but not in the same way. She was looking at Hiram narrowly, as if sizing up his worthiness. There was something strange about it. The times I'd met her before, she seemed to look at Hiram with wonder and appreciation. Perhaps she was beginning to see him differently. The thought could not be helped, but a feeling of schadenfreude jumped up for me. Maybe she would leave him? Then she goes on to talk about she's furious at Hiram for tricking these people, and she sabotages his attempt to convince them that the Gadeon robbers are taken care of by screaming, "We will never go. You have no power. We will hunt you down, you and your children. Generations and generations, we will prey upon you like the beasts you are. We are the Gadeon robbers. We will destroy you." And that proceeds to set in motion the events that lead to Hiram's presumed demise, right?
Yeah.
You never know for sure from an explosion.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, that just that moment of treating the belief of the people who were following Hiram as something respectable, sacred even. Just that moment redeemed a lot of things for me and kept the book from getting too, too critical of the way those people were behaving and believing, because there was a lot to criticize about that community.
Yeah. One of my friends laughed the hardest when Hiram was trying to steal the dictionary from the library, because he didn't like the way the new librarian was making him use the dictionary where he had to stand. And so he was, instead of coming in and standing and looking up the word that he was looking up, he was going to steal the thing. And then he wanted to make, what was it? He wanted to kind of cover his tracks so that this librarian wouldn't know that he stole it. And so he made it a bigger deal. He broke things. He took a bunch of books and burned them and painted some things on the back of the library that started this whole paranoia of the Gadianton robbers coming with a communist agenda to take over the town, which led to this hysteria.
Which all happens because I think the paint happens to be red and something he spray paints happens to look like a G. Like,
yeah.
It's pretty funny.
So it's really funny, but it's this semi-innocent thing that he does. Like, he just wants to read the dictionary, but he won't.
Without having a confrontation with the librarian.
And it leads to this big, huge mess. And he's trying to just put it away. And she won't let him because he's not admitting to the whole story. So she's going to make him deal with it even longer by perpetuating the idea that there really are Gadianton robbers that are going to destroy the people of the town. So, yeah, that was both of those spots. Were just like, holy cow, what did he just write? They were really good. One of my favorite is, I have lots of favorites, but my favorite is when he's talking to Adam. Yeah, it's Adam that's the student that's working with him for the summer. And Adam had just told him that people that don't believe in evolution, that the, I don't know why people think that way. And it really messes with Hiram because he's always thought that evolution was evolution, that it was of the devil and not good. And he says, Adam stopped me with a laugh. I knew suddenly that my cover had been blown. I had asked some very unscholarly things. Even though I was trying to be a scholar, all of a sudden, I needed to really know something. It's hard to explain, but you go through life with a set of things that sort of form a bed for all the other things your head is full of to rest on. Stuff like when you get up in the morning, the sun is going to be there shining down on you. The cliffs that surround Moab were going to be red and not pea green, like the grass growing between the bricks that run the path up to your trailer. Some things get real comfy cozy in your head, and you expect them to be there so much that you forget that they are there. In fact, they are pretty much invisible. It's just not things that you can see and touch, like the sun and the color of the cliffs. Some things are a part of you that you can never see until all of a sudden something comes and wants to rearrange the whole thing. And this next little metaphor killed me, and I thought it also described the idea of being discombobulated or having your worldview shaken up perfectly. He goes on to say, it is like one time when I was going over to the neighbor's to deliver a package that the postman had left at our place. I'd walked over there 100 times, knew the way like I knew my own trailer. It was pitch black, and the desert stars were shining and a black sky sparkling because they didn't have to compete with the moon or lights from a city. All of a sudden, I was falling into a hole 6 feet by 6 feet by 6 feet. It seems that the road crew had been there during the day and just left a big hole there for some stroller to fall into. I was all right, besides being perturbed enough to throw all their equipment stacked around the area into the hole. But I thought how strange I felt when I was falling into space. It was outside of what I'd come to expect walking in my neighborhood. It was like this evolution business. Adam had just dug a big hole in my homey way of looking at the way the universe worked, and I had some rearranging to do, it seemed. Plus, if this was wrong, what else was wrong? Since taking the sacrament unworthy and heaping upon my head damnation, I'd been thinking God had marked me of one of his forsaken. Things were unsettled enough in my life. If I was an ape, it would explain a lot. And that whole scene describes what it's like to have something that you believed was true, or that you have your understanding shaken up significantly, that suddenly you feel out of control and your normal path that you take every day is disturbed. And when you do get up out of that hole that you fall into, you're usually pretty pissed off. And so whoever dug that hole for you, you're going to take out some anger on them by throwing their equipment in the hole. I talked with Mike Barker about this. He marked it too and like sent me a text message right away saying, man, that nails the experience of having your world turned upside down, at least momentarily, perfectly.
Yeah, and I think it's also a really good illustration of one of the major, you know, points or themes of the novel, which is that everybody's got some fictionality to their perception. Like, I like to say, you know, probably everybody has part of their doctrine that they walk around knowing is true that's false doctrine.
Yeah.
You know? And it's hard. It takes work for people to remain open to the possibility of probably I'm wrong about some things. And the, you know, the way this novel is set up, you know, everybody's wrong about some things, but you don't know which things. And neither do they. So I think that becomes one of the author's major points, is that we've all got some 6 foot by 6 foot by 6 foot holes that we'll be falling into at some point, and they're going to catch us unawares, and we're not going to enjoy finding out we were wrong, or that there are real experiences that exist outside of what we previously could wrap our brains around. So, you know, a good part of what I think this novel does well is explore that idea.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, one of my favorite, it's not a favorite moment, but the whole use of language, I love that. And so as I'm, you know, as Hiram is using inappropriately all the time language from the Book of Mormon or little Utah-isms, as I call them, All of that that was sort of weaved into everybody's language. I don't know. It just made me smile and it lightened the book up. It could have been an awfully dark, cynical book. And I do think that there were just these touches of you know, poking fun, humor, but not in a malicious way, in a kind sort of way. And I got that all throughout the book. That's, I don't know, it's probably the thing I liked most about it.
Yeah, like I had said before, I thought the language was really interesting and entertaining to kind of capture the different dialects of the different people throughout the book. Were there any other moments or parts that you found particularly poignant?
Well, there's one other thing from near the end of the twins' life. This is on page 263 where William is talking. He says, and Edward is sort of losing touch with reality, and he talks about that. It may be that there will be no explanation that will offer itself to disclose the reasons for Edward's departure from the world of cause and effect. We stand in relationship closer than any human beings really ought to. I've been there for all his experiences. We started with the same phenotypical brain at birth, genetically identical heads. We've had identical experiences, identical nature and nurture. Yet here we are, he gay, me straight, he religious, me a non-believer, he mad, me clinging to rationality by a thread. And back to part of that duality, that was sort of my statement in the book that represented that, that you have, yes, the physical duality of the twins, but each of us has that internal duality that we fight all the time. One of us is rational and trying to hold it together, and maybe the other's a little bit insane, and you guys kind of touched on that and what you were just saying, but that was a moment for me in the book that was really poignant.
Yeah, I really liked that part. I had forgotten about that, and that made me think for a long time a lot about the ideas then and the arguments I have back and forth in my head about all kinds of things. It's like you have two voices. It's like you have the atheist and the believer inside your head. At least that's my experience of having both in there, and they're kind of questioning each other and pushing each other back and forth all the time. And sometimes it's really tiring, and I had to think that being the Babcock twins had to feel tired quite a bit.
I bet, yeah.
All right. Well, any other points you want to make or thoughts on the book? I think we've kind of covered most of the stuff in the little outline here. So any other thoughts or things you want to say?
Well, keep in mind, I read this right before at the very end of my last pregnancy. And so the treatment of Dora's birth was, as birth being such an alien frightening experience, was really interesting to me. I don't know many women who could write that way about birth.
Yeah.
And so, but it did feel kind of consistent with maybe my husband's experience with my birth, where I'm his wife, who's normally got this very tiny voice and is relatively subdued, is screaming louder than he's ever heard anyone scream in his life. Like, that's probably does seem kind of alien to him. But that, and there were a number of other moments in this that just came across as a very male perspective for me. And, you know, that's the experience that women tend to have reading books, is you have to learn how to relate to a male perspective. Mm. But a male perspective on birth and treating it as something so frightening and alien was interesting for me, especially given the timing of my encounter with the text.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, and I mean, you're reading it from the Babcock twins' perspective, and Dora jumps up and takes off running, and they think there's a second baby attached.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They're terrified that she's dragging this baby on the ground, and it's I think there's a perspective from which that scene could be really funny, but it's written as being so terrifyingly strange that that was a really really interesting part of the text for me that I'm still processing months later. So.
Yeah, it does make you think in that, in those moments, what was going on in Dora's head to go through that experience and then, you know, run off as she does. That yeah. That kind of like Milt was saying with a longer version of the book, if you had more depth, more length, you could get more depth out of those characters. You could understand Dora more deeply, maybe, in a fantasy world where the book's twice as long.
Yeah. Now, Dora just sort of seemed to exist so that we could have a poetic perspective and so that we could deal with how do you square someone who believes something that seems so highly improbable, but they so clearly do believe it.
Yeah.
Her character kind of functioned to do those two things, and I wish she could have done some more things with that character, mm-hmm. because she was very interesting.
Yeah.
And what happened to her was obviously very interesting, although never resolved, so we don't know what happened to her. Whatever it was interesting.
All right, Milt, any other thoughts? Or
no, not really.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, so kind of going off your closing thought there about the gendered perspective of the book, the next one will be fascinating to contrast to this, Maureen Whipple's The Giant Joshua. Stories about polygamous women written by a woman. From what I understand, she researched very thoroughly the history of the era that she was trying to capture. So it'll be really neat, I think, to compare just the different authors, the different objectives. You know, we're covering a broad range of, you know, any Mormon that writes Mormon fiction. But I think it'll be fascinating to just see how those compare against each other.
Yes, and I pulled it out. I was really excited after reading the preface, especially the last paragraph, mm-hmm. Because she's writing based on the experiences of her actual progenitors, right?
Yeah.
And so she says, "I believe we detract from their achievement when we paint them with too wide a brush. These people of whom I write are my people, and I love them. But I believe that what they did becomes even greater when we face the fact that they were human beings by birth and only saints by adoption." So I'm really excited to read that book.
Yeah, I read that preface last Sunday, and I got all excited.
That preface.
Yeah.
I've read the book, and I'd like to go back and kind of revisit it. But it really, you know, you have this view of pioneer Utah, and it's almost always from a male perspective. And this book will just, I mean, it just, to me at times, it was just stunningly sad. But it really details how difficult it was for women, especially in that southern Utah area, to colonize back in the day.
Yeah, we might have to bring our tissues for the next discussion. So Ben Park, for listeners that have listened for a long time now, this last year, he and I went through 10 books about Mormon history. And one of his first academic papers was the insider response, or the Mormon response, to the release of Maureen's book. And so I'm going to have him on, just kind of get a feel for how different people within the church responded to this, from what I understand, a candid telling of the pioneer story. So look forward to that. So thank you, Emily and Milt, for participating. This was a lot of fun. We probably could have talked longer, but it was a lot of fun. So thanks for reading. Thanks for participating.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that. Again, like I said, our next book will be The Giant Joshua by Maureen Whipple. So look forward to that. And as for next time on the podcast, I'm working on finishing up editing so I can release the next episode, which is an interview that Laurel and Thomas did with Kirby Hayborn, of all people, that you probably remember from some of those early 2000s Mormon movies. So look forward to that, and until next time, as always, keep keeping it weird.